Welcome back to Special Sauce, the podcast about food and life with me, Ed Levine, founder of Serious Eats. In our last episode, I invited three of my esteemed food colleagues to reflect on some of the changes or trends they saw in their reporting and writing during this past year. First, Pete Wells, restaurant critic for the New York Times.
The pop-up thing, it's like a subculture, and I think it's very generational, you know? Like, I think even people my age almost find it hard to find the frequency that all this is being broadcast on. I mean, people in their 20s right now, it's all just second nature to them. I think that's part of the appeal of this culture, right? It's like some people know about and some people don't, which is really cool and has been, you know, kind of erased from our society in a lot of ways.
Hannah Goldfield is the New Yorker's food critic and writes the weekly Tables for Two restaurant column.
This feels like there's this new kind of economy for chefs to be sort of freelancers. And I've talked to some of them about this, and some of them really, I think, love the freedom, and some find it sort of exhausting to have to just be constantly kind of chasing after your next gig. So this new sort of generation of young chefs who are kind of just bopping around and doing sort of limited residencies or, you know, one night dinners or whatever, but they're making careers out of it. And I think it's hard. I think it's a hustle, but the trade-off is they don't have a boss.
And also at the table, Brett Anderson, the New York Times food writer based in New Orleans.
I do feel like you're seeing more people who see being a chef or a cook as their sort of creative side hustle. That doing it full time just isn't worth it, doesn't pay enough, it's too arduous, but they don't want to totally give up the thrill and the pleasure of cooking for other people. I've seen some of that, and I would imagine we'll see more.
This week, we turn our attention to the future. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Special Sauce. So, what are you most excited about as you look forward in the restaurant world or the food culture? And what are you most worried about? I know those are two cosmic questions, but what the hell? I'm going to go for it.
When Brett was talking about the kind of possibility of a brain drain out of cities because of the high cost of overhead, I was thinking that I'm actually not worried about that. It's exciting to imagine being able to find really amazing food in whatever random small cities around the country, because people have decided to move home or move to be closer to their parents or just pick a random place where that is more affordable. And the idea that you could go to a really wonderful restaurant there, even if it's only for lunch, that's really exciting to me. And I think that the market here is so oversaturated that I don't actually think that if that happens, that means it's detracting from the creativity in New York, because I think there are still there's always going to be people who, you know, it's New York or bust, and they're willing to just lay everything out on the line and have that kind of ambition. So I think actually that might just be a way for people who would otherwise get discouraged and go do something else to actually just to sort of spread it around. So I guess I feel strangely optimistic about that.
That's good. And what are you most worried about then?
I mean, there are lots of things to be worried about. The rent thing that we talked about, and the idea that the industry won't, you know, actually move toward changing to be a more equitable, you know, happy place to work. I guess I have those kind of existential worries. But in general, I feel like it continues to be a really exciting time to write about restaurants. I've just been stunned kind of over and over again by how many wonderful things there are to eat in this city. This is so uncharacteristic of me. I'm a worrier, and I'm kind of a pessimist, but I feel like the world is ending, but you can still get a great meal in New York.
That's good. What about you, Pete?
Oh, I'm always worried that somebody is eating something really delicious that I don't know about. I mean, that's like that's my number one fear, whether I'm awake or asleep.
FOMO.
I do kind of in a much less kind of pit of the stomach way. I kind of worry about this growing stratification. This high end of restaurants is just getting more expensive. There are more and more of them, and often, in my experience, the most interesting places. Often, like you're kind of paying to be sheltered from surprises, which I think is a privilege of the wealthy. But that's a very abstract worry. I just sort of sit and look at that and scratch my chin, because I do feel like it's not that the lower end is disappearing. The lower end is still pretty interesting from my point of view. But I guess I do worry that, these places that are just for people who really have no money problems at all are kind of soaking up more attention than they deserve. And let's see, I mean, am I optimistic? I'm really optimistic about the ability of restaurant owners and chefs generally to kind of, think their way out of problems and think their way out of challenges. I think it was just amazing in the pandemic to see, like, once everybody, realized, okay, we might be able to survive here, like, for example, when outdoor dining came along, people thought about it in very creative ways and just sort of tried to recreate the, environment they had inside, or tried to do something completely different and just kind of rolled with it in the way that you think of, like, theater people who, there's some emergency 20 minutes before curtain time. They just figure out a way so the show can go on. And there was so much of that in the restaurant business that was so encouraging. And I mean, it made me think really that there's like this untapped well of creativity in the business that maybe, it'd be nice to draw on it a little bit more, because normally everyone's so concerned about, following trends, just copying what everybody else is doing. And it was cool to see they could all think for themselves. I'm not saying I want more pandemics, we don't need more viruses necessarily, but I do think, like, there is now this whole generation of people who have had experience in having to think outside the box really quickly when everything was on the line, not to mix metaphors too much. So I'm kind of, I guess heartened by knowing that this, business that I'm all wrapped up in covering can really be so resourceful at the right times.
I remain very concerned about the ability of mid-range restaurants to survive given all the headwinds they are confronting as we move forward. I'm also worried about the survival of restaurants in formerly densely populated downtown business districts of cities in an era when more and more people are working remotely, either part or full time. Many restaurants will not survive, I'm afraid. And yet, I think that the creativity and the problem-solving skills displayed by the chef community during the pandemic will result in lots more good food being served to serious eaters, even if it's prepared and served in different ways. Lastly, I'm really looking forward to seeing the continued proliferation of restaurants serving underrepresented cuisines from around the world. Coming up, our panel discusses representation not just in kitchens and on menus, but also in the range of restaurants they've been trying to cover in their work. That's next, right after the break. You ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? I just bought a beautiful new carbon steel flat bottom wok. Now I really want to get the most out of it. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability. that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. What do I mean? Well, the all-new Lexus GX can come with 33-inch all-terrain tires. Those would make my driving on dirt roads near my house a lot smoother. Just like the flat bottom on my new wok will enable me to up my cooking game. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
One of the things that's great about what all three of you have done, Brett, especially when you were a critic, is that you're not distinguishing between, you know, roast pork trailer in the Bronx and a $500 omakase menu at a sushi bar. And I think that's good. You know, removing though, it's like when something is delicious, it's delicious. It doesn't matter what it costs or who's making it. And I think that's one thing the pandemic has also brought out is the realization that up and down the socioeconomic ladder, people want to eat well. And you can eat well getting roast pork platter in the Bronx, and you can eat well at a inexpensive tasting menu that Brett has written about. And I think that's a good thing, right, moving forward. Brett, what do you think about that?
You know, I agree with this idea that the pork cart in the Bronx is every bit as worthy of our attention and respect as an expensive omakase place. In terms of my worries, sort of hearkening back to something we talked about earlier, I do worry of the ability of restaurateurs to continue to innovate and be creative in the way that Pete described, which I too have been very impressed by, enough to stay afloat. You know, I do worry that some of the debt these people have taken on due to COVID, that the bills will come due in a way that we could see the restaurant business in the United States lose a large percentage of smaller business owners, and that we see parts of our cities in particular taken over by large corporate chains. That's something I really worry about. And I think that would not be to the overall benefit of anyone. And I'm going to continue to worry about that until I see reason not to. In terms of like sort of a kind of an old fashioned thing to be optimistic about, and I say old fashioned in the sort of journalistic sense, you know, one of my favorite restaurants that I ate in last year was Khan in Portland, Gregory Gourdet's place. He's a Haitian American chef in Oregon, and Kanji in Austin, Texas is another really dynamic and dynamite, I think, Caribbean American restaurant. I also think of Nina Compton's cooking here in New Orleans. She's from St. Lucia. I think of Kane in Washington, D.C. I know those owners opened a Trinidadian place. Kane is the Trinidadian place, but St. James is a new restaurant there. I'm just finding that particular, you know, the rise of prominence in cooking from that part of the world in the United States to be one that's particularly exciting to me.
You know, but that is one of the things that I think we're all excited about is that underrepresented cuisines that were underrepresented before when the world consisted of American, mostly American, French, Italian, and Chinese, and maybe Indian. And now people are going both deeper into those cuisines. So you'll see aspects of Indian food that haven't been represented on restaurant menus. But you'll also see, to your point, Caribbean food or West African food. And that can't help but be a good thing, both in their pure and in their integrated state.
Yeah, absolutely.
What you're talking to comes back to the same topic that's come up through this whole conversation, which is barriers to entry, that very often, you know, the reason Caribbean food wasn't getting a lot of attention was because the owners faced a lot of economic and geographic barriers to getting their food in front of, you know, people like you and me and Brett and Hannah. I kind of live out near the Caribbean center of Brooklyn, and there's some great places to eat out there, but I'm not sure they're restaurants. They like some of the best places are takeout shops. And even though, like, I, you know, I've tried to adjust my thinking a lot during the pandemic to, like, you know, does a restaurant have to have chairs? Well, maybe not, you know.
But what about still, tables?
Right. I mean, right. Is it a restaurant if it's just a pure takeout, you know, stall? But yeah, there are all kinds of mostly, you know, immigrant owned businesses that are in these little tiny, like, you know, envelopes of space where there's no room for a table or a chair. And they may be terrific cooks, but they're not until recently, you know, getting the attention of restaurant critics. Obviously, I think if you can open a real restaurant and, you know, where there's really a place to sit, you know, you can have a more complex experience going on there, and you can represent your culture in more ways than you can if you're putting everything in a takeout box. My mind has opened a lot recently to, like, you know, these questions, and sort of, you know, I've spent a lot more time thinking about, you know, whether I can include places that were, you know, traditionally overlooked by me.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of bakeries, for example, will have a counter in the back where they're making savory food. You know, I've seen that in Mexican grocery stores in Brooklyn and Queens, and I think you see it in a lot of West African grocery stores as well, and Indian and Pakistani places for that matter.
And none of them would have, you know, struck somebody in my job as, like, a reviewable venue, maybe until the pandemic, you know?
Hannah, you've also written about places that aren't strictly speaking restaurants, and that speaks to this issue.
I think I have a lot more freedom than Pete does because I, you know, Tables for Two existed before I became its sole writer, but I'm the first person to write it consistently. And so I've been kind of able to make it what I want to make it. And I think my editors allowed me, and they helped me really shape it and sort of adapt during the pandemic, especially. So yeah, I feel like we've blown it open. It's called Tables for Two, but oftentimes there are no tables. When you're within the framework of the New York Times, which is like the restaurant review, it's like your readers are expecting a certain thing. I decided during the pandemic, you know, if you can eat it, I'm gonna write about it. And I tried to come up with a theme or, you know, some justification to make it kind of fit into the general framework. But I've definitely taken it as a way to cover places that wouldn't normally get covered.
Pete's review of the roast pork trailer in the Bronx somehow made it onto page one of the New York Times, which was pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
And just shows that one of the things that Pete has brought to the job is expanding what can be reviewed and what is worthy of being reviewed.
Whatever you do in you know, as a writer of ostensible nonfiction, you know, you have to always be asking yourself if the world is changing while you're watching it. And then, you know, is it still in the same place where it was when you went to bed last night, right? So if you're writing about the world moves and you have to, you know, turn your head when it does, or else you'll be staring at nothing, you know?
Any of you have any New Year's resolutions that relate to your job? And if the answer is no, it's perfectly fine.
I don't normally do New Year's resolutions.
Okay. That's okay.
I'm not disciplined enough.
I always make them and I never stick to them. But mine are so banal and embarrassing that I don't think I'm going to.
You're not going to share them?
Interesting.
You're not going to share them?
I mean, one of them is to file my expenses on time. That's like a major thing I need to do. And the other is to try to refrain from eating with abandon when I'm not on the clock, because a friend of mine described this job recently as athletic, which is, I think, accurate. Yeah, I feel like I got to rate it in some way or another. But that's such inside inside baseball.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, when I was writing for the Times and I was eating 200 hot dogs in 2 months, you think filing expenses for the New Yorker is hard? Try doing that for 200 hot dog stands.
Oh my God. That is actually a nightmare. Like I'm going to dream about that and wake up in a cold sweat, truly.
What about you, Pete? Are you a believer in resolutions?
I don't remember to make them. And then once I make them, I don't remember to do them. But I do think that as a general rule, you know, it's good to be mindful of the off-duty eating. And I think, you know, anytime you find yourself facing some food item that's too big to hold in one hand and you're telling yourself, you know, and you're telling yourself, it's okay, it's just research. You know, I think it's time to reassess some of your choices.
Yes. I think that's something all four of us have lived in our lives for a long time. At least I know I have.
You know, I will say one thing in New Orleans is that the kinds of things people vow to do on New Year's elsewhere, people I think here reserve for Lent.
Oh yeah.
I have tried to cut back on starch in the past. And it's not easy.
I hear you. Well, Hannah Goldfield, Brett Anderson, Pete Wells, thanks so much for sharing your special sauce with us. Your insights are impressive and greatly appreciated. Check out Hannah's reviews in the New Yorker and look out for Brett's terrific reporting and Pete's reviews in the New York Times.
It's a pleasure for me too, you guys.
Me too.
Thank you. This was a great afternoon.
Well, serious eaters, that's all we have time for today. What are your thoughts about food as we begin a new year? What restaurants are you itching to try? What cookbooks are you studying and reading? And what kinds of ingredients are you hoping to experiment with? Follow me at SeriousEaterEd on Instagram or Ed Levine on Twitter and let me know. This episode was produced by Pedro Rafael Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez of PRX Productions. If you want more special sauce in your life, just subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to thespecialsaucepodcast.com where you'll find every episode we've ever done. I'm Ed Levine, and thanks for listening to Special Sauce. See you next time, Serious Eaters.